to find out what many of you are up to. So I'm assuming the audience is predominantly not condensed matter people, although I see a few of my condensed matter friends from the university here. And my idea here is to just give you an idea of two or three very simple basic problems in condensed matter that many people are studying. And I'm going to focus on problems which in which the ADS safety correspondence, the hope is, will lead to some new insights. It has already helped in many cases, but there are many open problems also. All right, and the particular problem I focus on the condensed matter side, I worked on my two of my students, Yejin He and Max Matlitsky. And here are a bunch of particles slash string theorists who've taught me a lot about the ADS-CFT correspondence, who I've collaborated with in various papers that I've briefly mentioned. Okay, so here's the outline, and of course, please interrupt me at any time. I'll begin with work that's about 2 years old, which is thinking about transport near quantum critical points. Philosophically, this is quite a lot of similarities to ideas where ADS-CFT being applied to the quark gluon plasma, and where the focus has been on the viscosity of the plasma. There are corresponding questions in condensed matter, which in fact was studied for a much longer time, where also ideas from ADS-CFT have led to new types of insight. But I'll be very quick on this because, in fact, I spoke here at Perimeter on some of this 2 years ago, I think. Then the most of my talk, if my timing is correct, will be on some open problems. And I'll begin with a problem that's is fairly well understood, which has to do with phase conditions of system in Dirac fermion systems. But where there's really very little understanding and a lot of exciting new developments in the past year, both from the ADS-CFT side and also from the condensed matter side, are problems associated with Fermi surfaces. And quite unexpectedly, it seems like there is also a genus expansion there that we have to worry about. Okay, so that will be the main part of my talk. All right, so let me just quickly review, and if it's too quick, slow me down. On some basic problems on quantum critical transport. So one canonical phase transition, quantum phase transition that many of us study is the superfluid to insulator transition. And a beautiful example of this is found in cold atom systems where you have atoms with bosonic atoms in a periodic potential, and they either tunnel freely through the entire lattice, forming a Bose condensate and hence a superfluid state, or they're trapped if the potential wells are deep enough. Then they get trapped in a way that it doesn't pay to tunnel anymore because you've got to pay the repulsive energy between the atoms, and you get an insulating state. And so there's a phase transition at zero temperature between these two different states of matter. This happens in any dimensions, including one. So if you want to now understand the theory in the vicinity of this critical point, then here's a lightning survey of how you do it. You start with the insulator, which has, say, in this picture, one atom per unit cell, and U is repulsive energy between the atoms. And then let's think about it. How is this thing going to Bose condense? Well, it's going to Bose condense by having the atoms move around. So when you move the atoms around, you create two types of excitations. You have particles, sorry. You add a particle on a site that costs energy U, and I'll think of that as psi dagger. And then you have holes, so you remove a particle from a site. So unlike the normal non-relativistic Bose gas, where you only have particles and the vacuum is empty space, here the way to think about it is the vacuum is the mod insulator. And so you have both particles and holes about this vacuum. And you get a mod insulator, this insulating state, only if the number of particles equals the number of minima, or in terms of the excitations, if the number of these excitations are equal, plus and minus excitation have the same density. And this particle hole symmetry, essentially in the long run, when you work it out, and I won't go through the details, implies that the field theory describing this transition is a very familiar field theory. It's just the five-fold field theory that you meet in when you first learn quantum field theory, where the field phi, of which I call psi here, has two components, and it's relativistic. And the reason it's relativistic is intimately connected to the particle hole symmetry. So then you have a phase transition where the Bose condensate are these particles or holes above the Mott insulator. It's not the Bose, in the normal Bose-Einstein theory, you know, it's just every boson condenses. Here, better way to think about it, you have a Mott insulator and it's the particle hole excitations above that insulator that condense. That's the field psi, and then when they condense, you get a superfluid, and when they're not condensed, you have an insulator which has a gap to excite to these particle and hole excitations. So as a function of this coupling G, or in the experiment U over T, you go from a superfluid to insulator, where you have a condensate or not. And then not only is this theory relativistic, at this critical point it's also conformal. So we have then a realization in 2+1 dimensions of a strongly interacting conformal field theory. And that's essentially, you know, as far as we know, that's a well-established rigorous statement that the leading critical theory here in a generic model of bosons with short range interactions is in fact this conformal field theory. It was one of the, and you can really show that through a variety of analytic and numerical studies. Okay, so what the kind of question we have been interested in is what is the transport properties of conformal field theory at finite temperature? And you get some rather complicated phase diagrams at finite temperature with finite temperature costless Tauless conditions. And phases with a superfluid insulator. And you can open up, you know, canonical textbooks in condensed matter physics and understand behavior here or here using conventional solid-state physics methods. But my focus here is on the intermediate regime called the quantum critical region, where really you have to then understand the dynamics of this conformal field theory at finite temperature. And so this region is somewhat analogous then to the quark-gluon plasma, which is then some very strongly interacting plasma of, in that case, described by gauge theory. Here it's described by the complex excitations of this 5-4 field theory, which in below 4 dimensions are very strongly interacting. So one, yeah.
So
yeah, that's correct.
So how many have CFT?
It's only a CFT at zero temperature, of course. So it's a CFT perturbed with a finite temperature. Absolutely. But that's a kind of a universal infrared perturbation, as you'll see in a minute. It's just a finite size in one direction. So one characteristic of this regime, the way we thought about it a while back, is that there's a relaxation time. And that relaxation time is just given by the only scale, which is h bar over kt. And one consequence of this unique scale, which is determined actually by nothing but the temperature and no other coupling constant, is that various transport properties are universal. So for example, the conductivity is universal constants, like the charge of the electron, if these were charged 2e bosons, and this universal constant then is some property of the conformal field theory that we'd like to determine. And this is entirely analogous to, in the QCD language, of saying that the viscosity to the entropy density is h bar over kb times the universal constant, which in the case of essentially classical gravity theory using ADS-CFT correspondence turns out to be 1 over 4 pi. So, but however, you know, how do we go about determining this constant? That's more been a focus of much of my work in the last decade or so. Well, you would initially think maybe it's not that bad. So if you take a CFT and put it to finite temperature, you know that, as I just said, it corresponds to putting it on a cylindrical geometry where the length circumference in this time direction is 1 over temperature. So why can't I just go ahead and compute correlation functions on this geometry? And sure, you can. There is, you know, as you know, for this 5-4 field theory, there's this epsilon expansion of Wilson and Fisher. There's various traditional 1 over n expansions of vector field theory that work extremely well. And they can give you very precise answers, but they only give you precise answers at these imaginary frequencies in the in Euclidean time. And in Euclidean time, the frequencies have to be integer multiples of 2 pi t. Or they can give you good answers at high frequencies, where h bar omega is much greater than kVT, or essentially t is zero, and then it's quite easy to go from here to there. And this regime is where, in fact, temperature doesn't matter, and so we can think of it as a collisionless regime because you're just looking at how the ground state absorbs energy by creating a few excitations when you put in a perturbation that oscillates at a frequency omega. It's like an optical absorption type experiment out here. But what we're really interested in transport is, and in that regime, I'm still talking about here, you can use conformal invariance to figure out the structure of the answer. And in particular, if you looked at this density correlation function, it's just the number density correlation function, then by conformal invariance, I won't go through the details here, but it's a relatively simple argument. The density correlation function has to have this form, where V is the velocity of the CFT, and K is a pure number, like the level number of a Kac-Moody algebra. And then if you apply the Kubo formula, it tells you the conductivity is that K is a universal constant, characterizing the conductivity. But the whole point is that this is the wrong answer for the actual DC conductivity. To get the conductivity, you have to really go to very low temperatures along the real axis. And there you get diffusion and hydrodynamics and collision-dominated physics. And that's the strong coupling problem. So even in a relatively weakly coupled field theory, which you can compute things to high accuracy, when you get to this regime of hydrodynamic collision-dominated regime, then these other methods just fail. And we don't have any complete answers in this regime. And so one of the magic of the ADCC correspondence, from my point of view, is that for a wide class of conformal field theories, it works not only over there, but also down to low frequency in this hydrodynamic regime. And in that regime, you get this diffusive behavior of the correlation function, very different from the conformal structure. This is the kind of answer you'd get from Einstein's Brownian motion type arguments, and that this conformal field theory should obey that. And the conductivity is determined by very different physics, having to do with the value of the diffusion constant, and nothing to do with the zero temperature Kac-Moody algebra, or the analog of that in 2+1 dimension. Anyway, so for certain CFTs like Super Yang-Mills, you can check all of this, and you do see this collisionless behavior at high frequencies and diffusive behavior at low frequencies. Okay, so I went through that quickly, I admit. I'll go slowly from now on, but that's kind of a survey of one class of problems that ADS-CFT has been quite useful in giving us a whole new type of results that, the main point being that in this complex plane, there is no other method which works everywhere in the complex plane uniformly. ADS-CFT is a unique thing that works everywhere. Other methods, vector 1 over n expansion, epsilon expansion, tend to work, only at these very special points in the complex plane. And then, as you might say, well, what's the big deal? You know the answers at these points, and by analytic continuation, you know them everywhere. But of course, the analytic continuation is strongly ill-posed problem. And any errors here can make exponentially large errors, even along the real axis down there. Anyway. Okay, so that concludes part one of my talk. I'm not going to refer to it much more, just to give you a quick survey of a lot of work that's been done. Any questions on that? Yeah.
Metasystems, there is this CFT like regime. What's the typical value of the velocity?
It depends on the system, but say in graphene, the velocity would be 1/100 of the velocity of light, so a factor of 100.
But it's never 1.
Oh, no. Much smaller. So, and graphene is probably pretty high, so in these ultra-cold bosons, it's probably much, much smaller because the whole energy scales are only at least a factor of 1,000 in medium. So it could be 10 to the 5 slower than the velocity of light. So it can have a wide range, but it's certainly much smaller. So the relativistic behavior is emergent. It's from, in this case, a particle full symmetry. Mm-hmm. And in graphene, there are also similar constraints.
By some sense, it's a different relativistic behavior than the one observed on the ADS side, where the velocity is, you know, some very close to the speed of light.
No, but we would take a theory on ADS, which is where the we'd have to take the same velocity on the ADS side also, which is this small velocity v. Right. So, okay. If I go back to this field theory here, this field theory has a velocity v.
Right.
And this is presumably dual to some theory on ADS, which this Polyakov-Klebanov have this higher spin gauge theory. That theory will also be relativistic, but at the same velocity v. That's the theory we're using.
I guess my only point is that if the explicit examples that you construct correspond to a particular value of that v, and that value of v is actually very large, I mean, from your perspective, from close to the speed of
light. When I'm comparing with experiments, I need to know the velocity, and I can't, you know, I can work in units that v is 1 almost all the way, but at the very end, I have to put it back. So, for example, here, in the diffusion constant, this number theta 2 is a property of the CFT. So I could, for example, use ADS CFT to figure out that pure number. It's a dimensionless number. But when I compare with experiment, this V is something I need to know.
So you take a phenomenological approach. You compute something that's V-dependent in some sense.
Generally try to focus on things that V cancels out. But if at some point it doesn't, then you have to put it back in. Absolutely. Yeah.
Can you say briefly what the physics is that determines the value of V? Is that the tunneling between adjacent states?
That's right. It's some function of the tunneling matrix element between the neighboring minima and the repulsive energy of two atoms of the same size. So, and the lattice spacing. So you can get an energy scale which is T, tunneling, and the lattice spacing is the length, so that you get a velocity from that. That would be a good estimate. Yeah.
Just a more basic question, maybe. Whenever you have these approximation techniques that are in special places on the complex plane, and then you have this technique which covers the entire plane.
Yeah.
So can you see by looking at the same spot how the other techniques are failing?
If you just apply the other technique, and they'll be perfectly okay here. But if you apply it here, you'll get a lot of, you know, delta functions ad nauseum at every order. You know that. I mean, we know how to fix it in some uncontrolled way. That's what the Boltzmann equation does for you, is resum the thing to some high order. That's what we were doing before we learned ADS CFT, solving some complicated Boltzmann equations. But we had no idea how the act. That, it's an approximate method, and we have no idea of the accuracy or even how to improve it. It's very complex. Yeah.
Well, I guess that's what I was wondering, is if you have the full answer, then you could maybe get some insight of how to improve the approximate method.
Yeah, well, it's true.
I don't know.
Well, I mean, you have the full answer for some highly supersymmetric gauge theory, of course, but yes, absolutely, that might be helpful. Yeah, but those are, those are rather formal technical problems that, but nevertheless, very interesting, yeah. All right, so now let me that was 20 minutes, so good timing. Now let me talk about two problems, but they're not going to involve fermions, one of which we understand at some level. And
that's just to show you my objective here is even to convince you, hopefully by the end of this talk, is that even though we're not talking about systems with non-abelian gauge fields and a large end limit of some non-abelian gauge fields, there's still problems that are equal complexity, which the ADS method seems to be telling us something about. That's what I'm going to do. So this is actually motivated by a couple of experiments, and of course, just to show you some graphs. So the experiments are on the cuprate superconductors like yttrium, barium, copper oxide. And you may know that this is a system which is essentially a perfect square lattice with the electrons hopping in different directions on the square lattice. And then if you measure, this is a neutron scattering data, and if you measure at high energies or at high temperatures, and this is the intensity of the neutron scattering as a function of momentum in the x and y directions at a certain energy. And you see it's, you know, approximately circular, meaning the x and y are equivalent. And then as you lower the temperature, this measurements are, or you look at the lower energy scattering, you see this elliptical shape emerging. So there is some in this case, not entirely spontaneous, because the crystal has a slight orthorhombicity. It's a little different between x and y. And that tips the balance, and it always elongates in this direction. But the fact that it's elongating so much and in a, such a temperature and energy-dependent way means that it really should be thought of as a spontaneous elongation. That the system left on its own, all the electrons will decide cooperatively to move either along x or along y. In this system, they always move along this direction, and that's because there's a slight difference between the two directions. So that tips the balance. And that's important, that allows you to see it, because if it didn't tip the balance, then they equally move in both directions in different parts of the sample, and you wouldn't see a thing in your average moment, the whole thing. Anyway, so there's this order, this pneumatic order that develops, like in a pneumatic liquid crystal, where you have the molecules all aligning in some direction. These are not elongated molecules, they just point electrons, and they tend to move in one direction spontaneously. And very recently, there's been some beautiful experiments here by the group in Sherbrooke, seeing the same kind of difference between x and y by measurements of the Nernst effect. And this is a recent paper, and the title says broken rotational symmetry. Here they mean this 90-degree rotational symmetry of the square lattice, and they find that it's different. This Nernst coefficient is different along the two directions. Anyway, so this is the qualitative motivation for the two problems I'm going to talk about. All right, so let me just first talk about, so I'm going to look for this broken symmetry, just a very simple broken symmetry, the system deciding to, you know, go from a square to a rectangle, or from a circle to an oval, in both the superconducting and the metallic state. So I'll begin with the superconductor, where we think we understand how to do it. So, all right, a little bit of solid-state physics here. You start with electrons on the square lattice, just to show you where does all this relativity come about. In this case, it's also relativistic, almost. So these are just free electrons. They are sitting at these momenta, and that's the Fermi surface, which is known from various experimental probes. And so all the states here, if you have a free electron, these are occupied states, and those are empty states. Okay, that much we've got. Now you make the things to a superconductor. So superconducting means you add a pairing between the electrons. So you have some Bose condensate delta, that's a Kupo pair, which can create a pair of electrons, or vice versa. So that's the Bogoliubov-Hamiltonian, where you add this pairing term. And what we know from for the cuprate superconductor, this pairing term has a interesting momentum dependence. It has a D wave form, where delta K is positive when K is here and negative when K is there. And a simple function that does that is cosine of KX minus cosine of KY. Okay, so now you have a Hamiltonian with a free electron term and a pairing term. It's still quadratic, so you can diagonalize it, just choose some appropriate rotation in the part of the whole space. That's the Nambu procedure. And you get a new set of you get a Hamiltonian expressed in terms of a new set of fermions called the Bogoliubov quasiparticles. And they have a dispersion, I haven't shown this, which is just the square root of the sum of the squares of these terms. And this is simply, it's a 2x2 matrix. So this is the diagonal term, and that's the off-diagonal term. And then the eigenvalues are plus or minus the square root of the sum of the squares. And so now if you look at this dispersion, this is the excitation of energy of excitations above the ground state. You notice that it's always positive, except both when this and this term both vanish. Now, epsilon k is the Fermi surface. That vanishes on the blue line. Delta K is the pairing amplitude that vanishes along these diagonal lines where the pairing changes sign. And so they both vanish at these four points. So right near the four points, you have a Dirac-like dispersion spectrum. So that's where the Dirac fermions come in. So you can take a continuum limit near those four points. You have two velocities now. It's a little more complicated. You have the fermion velocity, what's called a velocity Vf in this direction, and a velocity called V delta in that direction. But apart from that, the low energy theory just looks like four two-component Dirac fermions, and these taus are various Dirac gamma matrices. So it's not fully relativistic, but anyway, it's just at least for one of these points, you can just rescale coordinate and make it completely relativistic. Okay, so the low energy theory of a D-wave superconductor consists of four Dirac fermions sitting at these special points in Boulanger. All right, so now I want to take the superconductor and have it break the symmetry. Okay, so actually, I'm going to break the four-fold lattice rotational symmetry. And if you were just thinking of the phase transition, you would say, well, that's very simple. There's two ways it can, you can distort a square. You can distort it this way or that way. So just an Ising autogram, you know, plus or minus, depending on which direction you distort the lattice to become rectangular. So, and everything I learned in my graduate courses about once you have an Ising autoparameter, that's just a five-fold field theory, just a real scalar field, and that will describe the phase transition of this Ising autoparameter. Ignore the stuff about time over symmetry breaking, I'll just skip that. Right. So then I can think of two different phases. One is the ordinary D-wave superconductor where the Ising autoparameter is zero. And then when I change some coupling, the Ising autoparameter is non-zero and it becomes rectangular. And among the things that will happen is that the position of my direct points would move so that it's rectangular this way when phi is positive and rectangular the other way when phi is negative. So you would think, well, that's the end of the story, but it isn't quite. Let me see this. And that's because you also, the low energy theory is not just the Ising autoparameter. You've also got these Dirac fermions, and they couple to each other. And how do they couple to each other? They couple by Yukawa term. So it's like a phi, psi bar psi kind of term that you all meet in any supersymmetric theory. And so now you have a theory to put everything together. You have a theory of a relativistic scalar phi, a certain number of Dirac fermions psi, and a Yukawa coupling between them. Now, it's not supersymmetric. It's not even relativistic. These gamma matrices, all the fun is in the fact that these gamma matrices are somewhat different. But the structure is just exactly that of what's called the Gross-Novo model, or the Nambu-Yasuno-Lasinga model. These are all essentially models of this type. And this will describe this broken rotational symmetry in a D-wave superconductor. Okay, yeah. So it becomes a Gross-Novo model for very special values of certain couplings and for the time over of symmetry basically. Anyway, so how do you analyze this kind of theory? Well, there is a large N expansion that goes back to analysis of the Gross-Novo model, and which you can apply here too. You just take a model where you have N Dirac fermions. You integrate out those Dirac fermions. You'll get some effective theory for the scalar field. And then with an NF sum out front, and you can just do the canonical, you can take the saddle point and do the 1 over N expansion. And this certainly works. There were a lot of complications in doing this because of the non-relativistic invariance, and that's what we worked out. But morally speaking, it's just the same familiar vector 1 over N expansion of that you know from the Gross-Novo model. And this is very similar to like the first part of my talk. This will work extremely well, except in this hydrodynamic regime, but everywhere else it seems to be okay. All right, so that's where things work. So now I'm going to talk about the same problem, but now with a Fermi surface. So let's now get rid of superconductivity. So I just have the original Fermi surface. Now, I'm sorry for I should have cleaned this up. But this picture is the same as this picture that I drew here, right? This is the same picture. And here, I put the gamma point, the k equals 0 point, the center. And in the picture that I'm showing you, I put that over the center is actually this point. If you think, since this is periodic, the Brillouin zone, around this point, there's a big circle of actually empty states. So there's a whole Fermi surface here, and that's what I'm showing you here. So in the cuprate, there's a Fermi surface, which is just essentially a circle. And these are the holes, occupied hole states. All right. So what we want to do is have this system now undergo a quantum phase transition, where because of various, before I get to that. So let me just remind you what we know about the physics of such a state. That's described by Fermi liquid theory, where you can put in electron interactions and understand something about the nature of the excitations around this, this surface, which is a line of zero energy excitations. So what we know is that the Green's function of a strongly interacting theory, which is a Fermi liquid, has a pole at all momenta on the Fermi surface. Omega equals k, when k equals kf, is a pole at zero energy. But when I move away from k equals kf, the pole actually acquires a finite width, moves into lower half plane, but that width gives omega squared, or equivalently as k minus kf squared. So there's some scaling function here, which you can compute depending on the details of your model. And so if I look at the pole of the Green's function of any kind of system with a Fermi surface, then there's a pole in the lower half plane, which hits 0, 0 exactly at k equals kf. And it comes in on this parabola. And as you'll see later, this is actually quite an analogy to quasi-normal modes of black holes, where you also get a whole bunch of poles in the lower half plane. And a Fermi liquid is that very special system where the pole just kisses this omega equals zero point. And this, you see, it's highly non-generic. I mean, if you just drew a random pole, it would cross zero at its imaginary part need not go to zero at the same part as real part goes to zero. And that's exactly what happens. And furthermore, the imaginary part is always much smaller than the real part, in fact, the square of it. And that's what a Fermi liquid is. All right, so we'll be interested in what happens to that near the phase transition and in this quantum critical region. So let me go back to my Fermi liquid. And now I want to have a phase transition where this thing distorts. And again, there's an Ising order parameter. And say when the phi is greater than 0, it distorts this way. And when phi is less than 0, it distorts the other way. So I can now draw a phase diagram, which is called the Pomerantuk instability, after Pomerantuk, who discussed it, I think, over 50 years ago, where you tune some coupling in your system. You have a phase where you are symmetric, phi is 0, and you have a circular Fermi surface. To one where it points in one of two directions. There's your Ising order parameter phi again. Okay, so now you could now try to do the low energy theory. What we want to do is understand the nature of this critical point. And you may say, who cares about this critical point? Well, the reason you care about it, again, is because of this canonical phase diagram. At finite temperature, then the Ising ordered phase would have a finite temperature phase transition. And this thing, along this line, it's perfectly okay to forget everything except the Ising order parameter. So in fact, along this line, you'd expect the Onsager exact results to apply for just a 2D Ising model. But along this point, it's not. At this critical point, you have to worry about the fermions and the Ising order parameter. And so this point is not just a 3D Ising model. It's something we don't really understand at all, in fact. And this point will determine the physics in this quantum critical region, which is one proposal is that's what's responsible for all the strange physics about PC and the cuprates of this kind of pneumatic ordering. All right, so how do we write a theory for this? Well, again, let's turn the crank. You've got the Ising model. you've got your Fermi surface. These are your non-relativistic fermions now. I've written this in a very non-relativistic way, where you have whole states occupied here and empty there, and E of k is some quadratic dispersion. But I don't really have to. I mean, I could, as I showed in this picture, you could imagine taking Dirac fermions, which are relativistic with some velocity v, and then you turn on a chemical potential so that the states up to some Fermi surface are occupied. And this would be a perfectly good system, which will have all the same problems and issues to worry about. So the important thing here is not that the fermions are non-relativistic. The important thing is that you have a finite chemical potential. And so the zero energy fermion excitations are not at a point, as they would be for a Dirac fermion, but on a line on the Fermi surface. That's the key thing. So any kind of Fermi system you can cook up, which has a line of zero energy excitations, would have enough complexity of interest for this problem. It would basically be the same. All right. So there's your Ising auto parameter, which initially looks relativistic. There's your fermions, which looks very non-relativistic, but as I said, you could make it relativistic, but you just have to have a finite chemical potential. And then you want to couple them together, and that's the Yukawa term. And this one is a slightly more complicated. Now you will have to have this so-called form factor here, just to remember that the coupling of phi should be positive, say, to fermions in this direction, and negative to fermions in those directions. So say phi is non-zero, you want phi to lower the energy in this direction and raise the energy in that direction. And that gives you this form factor, which changes sign as we go around the Fermi. That won't be very crucial for what I'm going to talk about in the remainder of my talk. And that's it, you're not here. All right, so there's the theory, with all the bells and whistles, nothing hidden. You have a scalar field, some fermions at a chemical potential, and a Yukawa coupling between them. And this factor, just to make sure you have the full symmetry right. And this is the theory I want to understand. As a function of lambda, what is the nature of the critical point? And this is a model that's been around in some form or the other for over 20 years. The mean field theory goes back to Pomeranchuk. People have even thought about fluctuations about mean field theory. And there's a huge amount of work, especially building on the work of Hertz. And the conclusion has been, this problem is really quite simple, and mean field theory is almost exactly correct. And what I'm going to argue now, that in fact, in two dimensions, that's simply not true. And we don't really, it's a strongly coupled problem when we understand very little about it. Okay, so this is the problem. Okay, now I'm going to get a little technical. So let's first analyze it in exactly the way we analyze the Gross-Novo model. What we do there, we just integrate out the fermions and got some effective action for phi. And because the fermions have zero energy excitations, the effective action for phi has various long-range couplings. Now here, the zero energy excitations are much more singular. They've got a whole line of zeros. And so correspondingly, the long-range interactions of phi are also very singular. They have this form here, this mod omega over Q. That's a characteristic Landau damping form of any Fermi surface. And the Q squared, of course, is analytic. And this looks very unfriendly, but the conclusion of Hertz and others was that, well, if you look at this, you notice that omega is going to transform in the same way as Q cubed. For these two terms to compete with each other, omega should be of order Q cubed. And this means that the dynamic exponent Z is 3. And then from that you conclude that, roughly speaking, each time, the time direction looks like 3 spatial directions. I guess this, since it was a Lipschitz workshop, you're all familiar with Z equals 3 now. So now if the time dimension looks like 3 spatial dimensions, you conclude, well, it just means, but in 2 dimensions, that looks like a 5-dimensional system, and that's just mean field. And that, it has been the conclusion, certainly was the conclusion of Hertz and many other people since then. But our claim is that this is just is wrong. And the reason it's wrong has been slowly building over the years, and there's been a beautiful paper recently by Sung-Sik Lee, which has really shown how wrong it is. And on a different topic, but it also applies here. So why do things go wrong? Well, so assume this is correct, that this is your, this is what the bosonic mode looks like. Well, you can go back and take your bosonic mode with this propagator and look at the fermion self-energy. And when you work it out, it looks like omega to the 2/3. So that's highly non-Fermi liquid-like. Remember, for a Fermi liquid, it has to go as omega squared. Right at the critical point, I'm losing my quasi-particle to the Fermi surface. I'm getting some strange branch cut behavior in the self-energy. But okay, you might think that's still not too bad because as far as the order parameter is concerned, I still have this basic behavior, and this overgapped mode is going to determine the critical point. Anyway, so suppose this is true. Well, if this is true at leading order 1 over n, let's put it back in the fermion-Green's function, and then I will get this imaginary part with a 1 over n here. And now this could be this is potentially worrying, because now you see that when I'm right on the Fermi surface, when k equals kf and omega is 0, I should emphasize, the Fermi surface itself hasn't disappeared. There is a special surface in momentum space where the Green's function becomes singular. Fermi surface has disappeared. What's changed is the nature of the singularity at that surface. And that's what we generally mean in solid state physics by a non-Fermi liquid. So now if you're out on the Fermi surface and at zero energy, then this term is going to be important. In fact, you already see at low frequencies is much more important than this term. But that's going to bring an n in the numerator. And so that could really mess up your 1 over n expansion. And in fact, that's what happens, as was shown by Sung-Sik Lee in a paper on a somewhat different problem. But the same structure applies to this problem, at least in this order. And what he showed was that these factors of 1 over n, which become factors of n because they're in the denominator, actually destroy the naive 1 over n counting for all planar graphs. And there's a particular way of defining planar graphs that I haven't explained here. Each double line is actually your Ising field, phi. And each single line is your fermion field. And what you've done here is you've fattened every scalar field into a double line. And why have we done that? Well, the reason is the following. So the singular part of the graphs come when every fermion is on the Fermi surface. So, you want to put k equals kf. The omega doesn't matter because it's much smaller than that anyway. You want to put k equals kf on every fermion line in your graph. Now, for each loop here represented by the dotted line, I have an integral over fermion momenta. And when I integrate over all fermion momenta, then, if for some k this fermion is on the Fermi surface, then this one here won't be because it's going to get kicked off the Fermi surface by this line. However, if this incoming line had just the right momentum, it wouldn't kick it off the Fermi surface. It would put it back on the Fermi surface. So there's some subspace of momenta over which you get back on the Fermi surface. And this double line representation gives you a way of counting the dimensionality of that subspace. So basically what you're saying here is that if you think of each boson, each field phi, as having two momenta, one is the momentum of this fermion, the other is the momentum of that fermion. And that's very much analogous to what happens in non-Hilbert gauge theory, where your gauge field has two flavors, two indices. One is of the two quarks it interacts with at the end of the line. And that's what's happening here, where you don't have a color, but you have a momentum label, which is a position label on the Fermi surface. So roughly speaking, what happens here is that position on the Fermi surface become, in fact, the n that's becoming large. And that's why you get the planar graphs. Okay. Okay, so that's words. I have no idea how to. So this is where we are, really, honestly. We are faced with the problem where you have to sum all planar graphs. all those sunk. And Max Metlitsky and I have some new results where we find that there are a number of these graphs that in fact lead to anomalous dimensions, and even the power counting is not right. So we have no idea, you know, how to sum these or what's going on. But this is really a completely open problem. There's been a lot of developments in the past year. We're just finishing up some papers on this. And it's looking extremely strongly coupled, in a very simple model, as you saw. Just a basic model of some scalar field interacting with the Fermi surface in two dimensions. Those are the yes, yeah. So above 2 and 3, the Hertz theory is basically OK. All right. So how? So let me then. How am I doing on time? Oh, I'm doing perfect. Any questions? So let me bring in. I mean, so there have been interesting attempts on trying to understand Fermi surfaces using ADS CFT, and I'll just show you what's come up from that. Yeah. There's nothing new out of that. I mean, that's only there, for example, for the quark-gluon plasma and D equals 4. If you run to D equals 3, for the M2 brain, there's no coupling constant there. So that, of course, makes life easier. If you have a coupling constant, there is no such analog there. You're at the critical point, and it's some generic critical point with no coupling other than the number of components. I mean, like superangles 3, the gauge coupling flows to some fixed point value, which is whatever it is, depends on the ultraviolet cutoff. Here, there is one coupling that you have tuned to put yourself at the critical point. But once you've done that, then so there is one relevant perturbation, which is just the mass of the phi field. And you've tuned that mass to 0. That's the only thing you've done. All right, so let me now just talk about ADS CFT. So you all know that now I'm talking 2+1 dimensions. So if you have a relativistic field theory here, I've written, this is to remind you of graphene, where you have the Dirac fermion, then pure graphene at 0 chemical potential is nearly conformal. It's broken a little bit by the Coulomb interaction, but anyway, these are just pictures. And that formally is dual to supergravity on ADS4, but let's just take the simple low energy limit of it, which is Einstein gravity. Then you can add a finite temperature here, and that leads to a Schwarzschild black hole in ADS4. And then you can, now you want a Fermi surface. So you raise your chemical potential, you've got a Fermi surface there. And now we know what the effect of chemical potential is on the dual space, and that corresponds to putting an electric charge on the black hole. And so you get a Reisner-Nordstrom black hole, at least formally. Of course, you know, these are very, very different theories here, but just looking at theories with the same kind of qualitative features. And this is the metric of the Reisner-Nordstrom black hole in a chemical potential mu and a magnetic field, which I won't need for this discussion also, but we can also put the magnetic field on there. And so then there's a connection between this black hole in ADS space and this system with the finite chemical potential, which is sitting on the boundary. So I guess most of you know. So the kind of thing you want to know is, what is the fermion Green's function? Suppose I create a fermion here and compute its Green's function. I want to understand something about its structure. Now, in graphene, it's a Fermi liquid, and I've told you, Landau Fermi liquid theory tells you that it has this pole in the lower half plane that hits 0 this parabolic way. So this picture is just of graphene, but I'm interested more generally. Suppose this system is near this nematic critical point, then there, what would it look like? What are the different types of Fermi surfaces I can get? So one way to do this is just close your eyes and do the calculation in the dual theory, and that's what many of us have done in the past year. And it turns out to be quite interesting. So here, you just take this metric, and you launch a Fermi field at the edge, and then you, I guess, analyze it here, and you get the Green's function of some very strongly interacting Fermi system on the boundary. If you're interested in some very strongly interacting, we don't even know which theory. If some theory which we think must have a Fermi surface on the boundary with very strong interactions of the fermions, and we assume that's equal to a free Fermi Green's function, which is moving through the box. So all we're doing is just computing the free fermions in this ADS-4 matrix. And so the pictorially, of course, you all know this, at very short times, you see the behavior right near the boundary where its metric is still ADS. And so you get the physics of the Dirac point. And at long times, when you go near the black hole, you'll get the physics of the Fermi surface. And in this case, the black hole, once you have a non-zero chemical potential, the black hole is present even at zero temperature, it becomes extremal. You know all this. So go ahead and compute this. Now, an important thing pointed out by McGreevy et al. I guess this is known, but I didn't know it. This is where I first saw it. There we go. So what's clear then, if you want to understand the low energy physics near the Fermi surface, I have to look at the near horizon geometry of the black hole. And in that near horizon geometry, it becomes actually ADS2 cross R2. So it's as if you have this R2, which is, you could think of as a momentum label on the boundary. So for every momentum in the two-dimensional system, you have a this critical system. It's a 1 plus 1 ADS2 system here with this ADS2 metric here. These X and Y are basically related to the X and Y coordinates of your boundary system. So zeta is a radial direction, and time is, of course, time. So you then have to figure out the asymptotics of the fermion-Green's functions in this geometry, which can be solved analytically, in fact, as these people showed. And from that solution in ADS2 plus R2, this is the Green's function they deduced. So what they found was, first of all, this is really, I think, the most important achievement of this paper, and also in this paper, which I guess has come out in Science, is they showed, essentially proved the existence. This was numerical, this is analytic. Proved the existence of a Fermi surface. In other words, they showed that this Green's function has this type of singularity where both the real and imaginary parts vanish at a given momentum. And the singularity now is not a Fermi liquid-like, but it has this exponent theta of k, which depends on k in a way they can compute. And the only parameter that comes out is the mass of the fermion, the scaling dimension of the bulk fermion. And this theta of k depends on the scaling dimension of the bulk fermion. And of course, my purpose in showing you this is that, you know, this is a few transparencies ago when I talked about the pneumatic critical point. It looked exactly the same with theta equals 2/3. We don't know whether 2/3 is correct. In fact, you know, we're pretty sure it's not in that problem either. But anyway, so it's looking very similar. what this all means is really quite an open question at this point. But it's, I think, quite exciting that you're starting to now see some dual models of some very strongly interacting problems with the Fermi surface. We just don't know what those strongly interacting problems are, at least in the boundary, right? but they have a form that's rather similar to this pneumatic transition. So I think the challenge now is from my perspective, is to kind of engineer using ADS-CFT this kind of pneumatic critical point where you can really understand the boundary theory also, and then solve it by the dual method. I mean, at this point, I'd be happy, you know, I'm not looking for, you know, for you to take the actual mass of the electron and the actual Hamiltonian, the cuprate. I just want any Fermi system with the Fermi surface, with a non-zero chemical potential, for which you can then say, well, here's this critical point where you break some symmetry. And that critical point is described, it could be any symmetry you want, some global symmetry. And near that critical point, I have this ADS dual description. If that could be achieved, I think it would have made great progress. Okay, we also computed things like quantum oscillations, and you get some highly non-Fermi liquid form of that. All right, so that's my conclusion. I've shown you basically two classes of strongly interacting problems where ADS-CFT hopefully will say something. And the first was the issue of this hydrodynamic collision-dominated transport. This was kind of a finite temperature, very incoherent regime. And the other one, which is also incoherent because you're losing your Fermi quasi-particle, but at zero temperature. It has to do with this bath of low energy excitations, even at zero temperature near a Fermi surface. But that's generally open, and I think where there's a lot of room for interesting new ideas. Already in the past year, there's been a lot of progress. So, thanks a lot. Yeah, so that's another problem here. This does have a non-zero entropy. And we certainly don't want to, I don't think anybody believes
that the actual experiment system has a finite entropy. So it's got to be relieved in some way. One cheat, you could say, well, at low enough temperatures, you go superconducting anyway. Or in the dual language, you get some scalar condensation. And then you get a regular black hole, which is not extreme. I think it would be much more satisfactory if you could have a system with a Fermi surface, an honest about Fermi surface, where you had finite entropy. Zero entropy at zero temperature.
Yes, I had a very basic question. So if you come from the condensed matter systems,
yeah.
So in which circumstance does the conformal symmetry arise?
In a few seconds, so the one I showed you was this critical point of the superfluid insulator condition. There is definitely, there is exactly conformal in the experimental system of any boson short-range interactions and a periodic potential. Another example are various, which I haven't discussed, there's a whole class of examples of transitions in anti-ferromagnets, where you're going from some spin gap state, either on a spin ladder compound or a couple ladder compound or in a square lattice anti-ferromagnet, to some kind of magnetically ordered state. So those kind of insulating states, there are now several examples where we believe it's described by relativistic field theories, which are conformal, and in fact, in some cases, even by gauge theories. But I think, in this last problem we discussed here, the formal invariance is totally irrelevant, in a sense. It's not crucial. So if I go back to this picture, this picture here. Now, if I take this to model my real world, this picture here, then this theory at high energies in the ultraviolet is conformal. It's got this relativistic fixed point here. But at low energies, you're referring to some other theory with this ADS-2 geometry, which has to do with the Fermi surface. So at that point, you've already broken conformal invariance by adding by going to this geometry by adding a black hole. And you're just looking at what's happening near the Fermi surface. And that's the part I want to understand. So even though the real system may not have this direct point, in fact, if it has the Fermi surface, I hope that I've still understood something about that. Okay, so at this level, the conformal fixed point is just some convenient ultraviolet completion. Condensed matter physicists will ultraviolet complete the Fermi surface by putting a lattice. And the application here is to make it conformal invariant. And we're interested in the part of physics that where that doesn't matter. That's another power, they call it the ADS-CFT correspondent, but it's a much more general correspondent. You can move away from the conformal point and still use it.
In this game, is there a story about this low viscosity like there is in the quark gluon plasma?
So very good to answer the question. So there have been a number of condensed matter systems where people of strongly interacting condensed matter system. Like cold atoms, we have the unitarity fixed point, and then graphene at high temperature, where we've done at least the theoretical work, where if we could go ahead and measure the viscosity, it would be of order 1 over 4 pi. And there's actually already measurements in cold atom system, but that's the case. So that's one. So there is a direct analog of that. Why it's in the cold atom system and close to 1 over 4 pi, nobody understands. But it's some low viscosity, strongly interacting fluid, of which ADS-CFT gives us a simple solvable model. That's the way to say it. But also, this, I guess I don't have this long. This conductivity at the critical point. Let me pull up another talk. Yeah. So I told you about, whoops. So here's the viscosity to the entropy density is h bar over kb kind of universal constant. That's what you can say by general quantum critical type arguments. And then the analog of that is a statement that the conductivity at the critical point is e squared over h times some constant of order 1. And that, you know, that is these kind of measurements that you perhaps have seen. This is, of course, now a system that's not conformal. It's not even anything. It's not just got a boson. It's electrons and a dirty substrate, which as you change the thickness of the superconducting bismuth film, initially it's superconducting. There, it's insulating. And right near the boundary, you have this temperature-independent resistance of order, this 4 e squared over h. And so now why is that number 4 e squared over h? That's never been understood. Now, the curious thing is that if you take ADS-C, if you assume there's some ADS dual, and just write down, let's take the Einstein low energy limit of it, Einstein-Maxwell, because you need a charge here. Just take Einstein-Maxwell theory on an ADS dual. And very generically, you can show that the critical conductivity takes the self-dual value. And there's a duality, which in ADS 4 corresponds to duality of electric and magnetic fields, and in this system it's a particle vortex duality. But the analog of the statement that the viscosity is always 1 over 4 pi in any theory of gravity is the statement that this critical conductivity has a self-dual value, because that's always what, that's the only thing that comes out of ADS. And this is indeed the self-dual value, so maybe there's something there, I don't know. This system doesn't have any duality, but in a vast number of experiments, you get numbers close to some sort.
If there are no more questions, let's thank you.